Venerable Ajahn Brahm, we are very fortunate to have him here in Sri Lanka after several years, and in between a very busy program, we managed to get a few minutes of his time to have a little discussion for the benefit of all of us. Welcome to Sri Lanka, Bante, once again.
Thank you. It is not getting a few minutes of my time. I've been kidnapped. But very happily so.
Sometimes those are happy kidnappings. So why don't I ask you a popular question, Bante? These days, mindfulness is becoming internationally famous, mostly because of the scientific introduction of mindfulness from the West. And now it is being taught in schools, hospitals, governments, and all over the place. And sometimes you hear nothing about Buddhism.
It is more accurate that such people do call it brainfulness and not mindfulness. And certainly you can see a CT scan of people's brains, you know, when they do various activities. But the lights which appear in somebody's brains are not what initiates the action. There is still a mind behind that. You know, it's not just seeing when you turn on a light, there is some light there. What's actually turning on that switch? So this is where that when one just focuses on brain, which is very materialistic, instead of a mind, we are losing a huge part of the real effect of mindfulness. And I did hear recently that, I think it was John Kabat-Zinn, I could be wrong, who was saying that Buddhism doesn't own mindfulness, giving a simile of that just because Newton discovered the law of gravity, it means that it's not English. And that was a very, not a very clever simile. Yes, Isaac Newton was English, but he was a scientist. So the law of gravity is science, in the same way that mindfulness is Buddhist. It's part of this great training, which we call Buddhism, and to actually to try and take it away from Buddhism. It would be like if, say, a computer company like Samsung just took over the operating system of Apple. They would never be allowed to get away with that. And so I don't know why psychology, modern psychology, has taken away one of the core operating systems of Buddhism, which is mindfulness. So I think it is very unhelpful, inaccurate, deceiving. I'm saying strong words here, but I think it's apt to call that mindfulness have been taken away from Buddhism and almost like orphaned from its parents. And it means that you've only got just this one tiny practice without all the other supporting factors of an Eightfold Path, such as ethics, such as compassion, which are also so important. So I've compared it to growing what we call a monoculture, just in a patch of land, just one particular plant and no other plants, which don't support one another. And anybody who's ever done anything about agriculture knows monocultures usually just deplete the soil. In the same way, just a monoculture, just mindfulness, without the support of ethics, compassion, and some other factors of mindfulness, which I really focus on, is stillness, which empowers the mindfulness. All of that is just taken away. And so that is a great shame. I think it's about time that the Buddhist world in particular really stood up and made themselves heard. In our modern world, Buddhism still has a very good reputation. And so much so that many people say, well, if we had to choose a religion, we'd choose Buddhism. And instead, they have no religion at all. In other words, the number of people in the world, whether it's in UK recently or in Australia, are saying they adhere to no religion is increasing. We do not need to be afraid that saying, claiming with authority and with good evidence to back us up that mindfulness is Buddhist. And we should reclaim it as if it's some cultural heritage which has been stolen from us.
Bhante, then how can we use this interest, which is positive in a way, because some of these people who practice mindfulness coming from the scientific base or the management schools, but they experience some amount of stillness and it makes some changes. So how can we in a way integrate that and get them to see the bigger picture, so to say, of the compassion and the stillness and the beauty of it? You know, it's far more lucid and bountiful than just being mindful, isn't it, Bhante?
Indeed, just mindfulness is just one part of it. And just even as it says in the Manipadaraka Samyutta, where this Yakka came to see the Lord Buddha and said that somebody who is mindful never gets angry, overcomes anger. And the Buddha replied, no, that is not true, that you need to have kindness, compassion, as well as mindfulness in order to overcome anger. And there is a quote straight from the great teacher, that mindfulness is not enough by itself. So we're asking for a lot of trouble here. When I was recently in Toronto doing at a conference on neuroscience, there was a professor of Toronto University was also presenting. He's a professor of neuroscience. And he said, you know, in front of the cameras, that he has looked at that research, not just the beginnings, but thoroughly examined it. And he said that research is far from conclusive. When people say that the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy does have a significant effect upon the brain, the way it is taught there, he's saying, that is far from conclusive. The only reason why it has got traction in our world, unfortunately, to say this, is a lot of money to be made on this. In other words, it's commercial interests is actually biasing the research. I know that as a scientist, that if you do any science research, you have to be very careful between causality and correlation. The obvious little example of that, many years ago, the tobacco lobby did some research which was quite conclusive that people who smoked cigarettes had a far less incidence of dementia, Alzheimer's disease. Until somebody pointed out quite accurately the reason why smokers do not get Alzheimer's disease is because they don't live long enough to get Alzheimer's. So sometimes correlation can be mistaken for causality. So if people do mindfulness training in the way that it's promoted for financial benefits of those teachers these days, the reason why it does get some effect may be some other causes, not just the mindfulness. Maybe it's just the fact that a person spends 5 or 10 minutes out resting, relaxing, not forcing their mind. That could be one of the reasons why there is sort of a result there. But whatever, that people do feel there is going to be some increase in some ability. But is it the sort of ability that we want to cultivate in our world? The ability of a person to exploit workers mindfully, to be able to shoot a gun mindfully so they don't miss. There is too many problems with just a technique which is just supposed to produce some benefits without assessing the ethical result of those benefits. So this is one of the problems here. And it might be the case, and this is a scenario which, you know, could actually work in the future, that because a monk like me has never done a course of mindfulness-based therapy, that I may be not allowed to teach mindfulness in the future because I have not got a certificate to do so. Now that's a scenario which you might think is going a bit too far, but I'm sure it may happen. This is an industry now with lots of money involved, and that means there's lots of dangers. Where there is money, there is corruption, as we all know.
Bhante, from that, shall we lead to the next logical question?
Yes.
How do we then combine mindfulness with compassion and all these soft qualities as well?
And first of all, it's called kindfulness. Mindfulness together with kindness. It's a word I coined many years ago. And when you add the kindness to the mindfulness, then it is an ethical quality, which means that if you are aware and you add the kindness, it means that there is going to be a much better result. A simile, which is easy for people to understand, which I've used a lot, is a simile of a wealthy person living in Colombo who came to listen to one of my talks one day at BMICH. And she told the guard of her house, she had a guard on the front gate of the house, "Please be careful of burglars. There's burglars in this neighborhood, and I'm going out for the afternoon. Please look after the house." "Yes, madam," said the guard, "I will be mindful." And when she came home, she found her house had been burgled. And so she scolded her guard. "I told you to be mindful." "But I was mindful, madam." "But we were robbed." "Oh yes, but I was still mindful. I was mindful of the burglars going into your house. I even noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I noted it and I didn't get stressed. I was very peaceful. And I noticed the burglars going out and I didn't sort of, my heartbeat never went up. I was very calm, madam. Burglar going out with your jewelry. I saw them backing in their truck. I saw them loading the safe into the back of their truck. I was mindful all the time, madam." Mindfulness without wisdom and kindness doesn't work. It promises much, delivers little. That is why you'll always see, sort of in Buddhist teachers, like my own teacher, Ajahn Chah, would never use mindfulness by itself, would always use satipanya, mindfulness together with wisdom, or in the suttas, sati sampajanya, mindfulness with also knowing the ethical, moral, compassionate consequences of your reactions to what was happening. Mindfulness taken apart from everything else is very dangerous.
Bhante, now that you mentioned the word sampajanya,
yeah.
Could you elaborate a little bit on that? Because I think that's the most important point here.
Because sampajanya, as anyone who knows basic Pali, knows sam means together with, and pajanya is just the original form of panya, from pajanati. So it literally means with wisdom. So it's mindfulness together with wisdom. And wisdom is, again, understanding the cause effects of your actions or your inaction in the case of the guard at the wealthy woman's house. It also includes the kindness in order to effect the results. It is basically, if you look at the Eightfold Path, that just before mindfulness, we have the effort, the aspirations, you know, that you have something to do, some purpose to, you know, what you're, when you're being mindful. In other words, if you're being aware and you're a driver of a car and you're driving me to a meal, I want you to be mindful of the traffic. And don't be mindful of talking to me. Don't be mindful of your smartphone, which is not really a smartphone, it's an iPhone, it's an idiot phone. So please, you know, put your mindfulness in the appropriate place. And that is the mind for the aspiration, the purpose, the mindfulness, and then we get to our destination. We settle, solve the problem. So it's important that the whole Eightfold Path is there for a reason. That every one of those factors support one another. And if you just take one factor out, you're going to be in big trouble.
Mantha, you mentioned about smartphones, and I think it's a good smart point to bring the new challenges we face in this modern world. And every time the evolution takes place, social changes takes place, new challenges comes to us. Today when we talk of addictions, couple of years ago we only spoke about addictions to alcohol, then we spoke about addictions to drugs, but today we have this great issue of addictions to smart devices, video games, and pornography spreading across all age groups. So, because of the internet, the pornography is so big and it's a multi-billion dollar industry. So it's very difficult for people to get escaped, whatever the ways that you do from a technological point of view. Bhante, what are the practical tips you can give to young and old of today to be able to steer through these dangers of addictions?
First of all addictions are running away from something, can escape into what, you know, is an unreal world. Sometimes when people come on a meditation retreat with me or stay some time in a Buddhist temple, they often say, oh, when we go back to the real world. And I pull them up on that constantly to say, what is your real world? For most young people, middle-aged, even elderly people, the real world is on a screen. Like many of you watching this, it's on a screen. This is not the real world. And to make that point, I used to think, why do I have to come to Sri Lanka to meet, you know, all the people here? Why can't you just see me on Skype? Or there's so many videos already. Why do you need to see me in person? And I'm sure that you all realize there's a huge difference in seeing a person live, face to face. There's more which you pick up in such a situation when you're real, looking, hearing with your own ears rather than mediated through some technology. It's much more imminent, much real. It has a different quality to it. So life, which you experience live, in real life, is far different than what you see on a screen. And a good example of that is not just why people have to come and see me personally, it's also why is it that people feel less of an ethical dilemma when they're standing in front of a screen, pushing a button so a drone in another part of the world sets off a hellfire missile which destroys people. They can do that because that distance, the screen, makes it far easier to act in an unethical manner. If you are right there in front of somebody, you find it very difficult to destroy them, to destroy their lives. In the same way, in pornography, for actually to be there in front of a person and seeing them abused, that is just intolerable. But when it's on a screen, there is an ethical distance between you and what you're seeing. You don't feel yourself so complicit in the bad behavior. That is its problem. So, the solutions now are first of all, to get people out there into the real world. But, to people to feel and see, what's really happening in this world. To have news not seen on a screen, but to take a person to, say, a funeral, to a hospital, to a poor village which has been destroyed by a mudslide, to feel, to smell, and to hear the cries of pain with your own ears. To feel those screams as if they were yours, but not just on a screen. In other words, for people to be kept real, to come back into a real world. In that real world, it may be more painful, but it's much more conducive to a sense of reality, freedom, and eventually liberation. I remember seeing a very well-known cartoon by the Melbourne cartoonist Lunig of a family watching their TV in the left half of the screen. The family were watching a nature channel, probably something like National Geographic or something. And there's this beautiful sunset, which is on the TV screen. On the right half of the cartoon panel was an open window where the sunset was actually happening. And there's a disconnect there somewhere. Something is very strange. We have people where life is really happening, preferring to watch it on a screen. We're living in virtual reality. Not reality. And just pointing out such things, people realize, what are they doing? Why are they not in the real world, living in a virtual world? A lot of it is fear. It is fear that being a little bit out of control in the real world. In the real world, if you talk to somebody and they upset you, you have to face the consequences. If you're messaging somebody on Twitter or something, you can just delete them straight away. You can't delete people like that. They're right in front of you. You have to listen to them, feel them, hear them, see them. So we're getting into a fake world, dissociating from reality. Even pornography, I don't know what it really means, but whatever it means, it's not a real world. There's a real people in there being abused. Why can't you feel their pain? Just because there's a screen in front of you, between you and them, that's not acceptable. So sometimes the fact that we feel that it's concealed, that people will never find out what we're doing. And that brings me up to a story. I don't think I've told this a long time. It was a story which I read in an old Hindu book. There was, say, a teacher in the old days, had many, many students, all male, about 16 or 17 of them. And he also had a daughter who was very, very beautiful. This is sexist, misogynist, but this is not the purpose of the story, to actually to talk about misogyny. This was another part of the story, so please excuse the fact that a beautiful girl, 16 young men who really liked her, and the teacher said, according to our custom, that I have to marry my daughter to one of you. Of course, takes no account of what the daughter thought, which is not really correct, but putting that aside, that I have to give my daughter to one of you. And I don't know, I have two problems. One problem is, I don't know which young man is worthy of my daughter. I don't know how to choose. And number two, I am so poor anyway that I'm not sure if I can afford, the marriage ceremonies and to set you up in your own house. So in order to solve both problems, and these days we never say as a Buddhist to kill two birds with one stone, that's very cruel. we have to change these old sayings to cut two carrots with the same knife. So to cut two carrots with the same knife, we're going to ask you to do a test. Now the test is this. I want you to go into the village close by late at night or early in the morning before the occupants of the houses have got up out of bed. I want you to creep silently into their houses and steal whatever you can. But please make sure that no one sees you stealing. And bring all the stolen goods back here. And the one who's stolen the most, the one who's most obedient and clever, that he will get the bride, my daughter. He'll win the test. And also that we'll give all of the stolen goods to the lucky young man, lucky young couple. That way I can find out who's the most obedient, who follows my orders. And number two, you know, that means I can solve the problem of paying for your marriage celebrations and also to set you up. And the students were quite shocked by that because their teacher was such a moral, ethical man. But they liked their daughter and they had a much stronger idea of obedience than we have these days. So, off they went into the village. They stole this, they stole that, always remembering that no one would see them stealing. And at the end of 7 days, the teacher said, "The test is over now. You've all stolen a lot of goods, except one of you." And this young man was very embarrassed. He said, "Why didn't you steal anything? Why were you so disobedient?" And the young man said, "But I was obedient, sir." "Well, did you go into the village?" "Yes, sir." "Did you crawl into the houses?" "Yes, sir." "When people were asleep?" "Yes, sir." "Well, why didn't you take anything?" "Well, you told me, sir, don't take anything if somebody was watching." "Well, you said the occupants of the house were asleep. They weren't watching. Who was watching?" At that point, the young man said, "I was watching. I was watching me break my precepts. I was watching me steal. That's why, following our instructions, I couldn't take anything." Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. At least I have one young man who understands what I'm talking about. Yes, it is true that you can watch pornography, you can do terrible acts, but someone is always watching you, and that is you. And so because of that, he said, "You can take all these stolen goods back. The villagers expected you." Some of them heard you, noisy young men. But they won't beat you or punish you because they were part of this test all along. "I'm already rich enough. I don't need anything from the villagers." And there's a beautiful little story about no matter what you do, there's always one person watching, and that's yourself. That's why the Buddha taught Hiriyotapa. You see yourself doing bad acts. You feel ashamed. You know the karmic consequences. So just because you can sit in a room and think it's private when you're watching pornography or doing terrible stuff, you're watching you doing this. That is enough for you to stop, restrain, get into a real world instead of a fake world with terrible consequences.
That was very powerful, Bhante. You were speaking about precepts.
Yes.
And I know you have said this several times, but I think it's worth asking. We are a traditional Buddhist society, means we have become Buddhists by birth. And from very small days, we are given precepts. In Singhara, we say we take precepts. Right? And there is this fifth precept, which is taken, but today it has become such a widespread norm to think it's okay to have a little bit of alcohol, right? How can we give confidence to people that it is not okay to have a little bit of alcohol if you are a Buddhist? I would like you to re-emphasize your message again.
Exactly. So the message, when people kept arguing and arguing and arguing, come on Ajahn Brahm, middle way, everything in moderation, just a little bit of alcohol. And so after a while I decided to give in and say, okay, it's all right to have a little bit of alcohol, but also have a little bit of murder, a little bit of stealing, a little bit of adultery, a little bit of deceit. Why is it the little bit is only applied to alcohol? And you ask any neuroscientist, a little bit of alcohol affects the brain. In other words, you do get less mindfulness. Even a small amount of alcohol just disturbs the functioning of the brain. Alcohol is a poison. And to make the point very, very clear, you put a saucer or a bowl of alcohol and give it to a thirsty dog. Not even dogs would take it. So why do you take it? Aren't you higher than a dog? Or is a dog higher than you? Okay, you understand? Please excuse me for being tough and fierce, but sometimes that's what people need.
Yes, Bhante.
In that precept we say we become less focused and we cannot keep our attention. And that brings to a question a student asked me once. Actually, the parents brought the student and said, this child has a serious problem. I asked, what is the problem? She cannot concentrate in studies. I said, yeah, that's a big problem. But when you are watching a movie or something, do you have the same problem? She said, no, uncle, it's not. Now, it's the same thing, Bhante. If you are looking at something interesting, we don't have to take any effort. But when we want to watch the breath, it's so difficult. Why is it?
So watching the breath.
It's boring.
This is where a person thinks they're entitled to happiness rather than making happiness. We live in an age of entitlement, of rights, privileges, which our fathers and forefathers have shed blood for. And we expect this to be just our rights, rather than putting forth the energy and the effort to actually to deserve enjoyment. In other words, after a while, if you just watch movie after movie after movie after movie, you too will not have any happiness from it. It too will be boring. And you find a nice partner to live with in life. You commit and get married, and after a few years of excitement, it's boring again. This is one of the problems in Sri Lanka and the world, because of the entitlement to happiness, that people get depressed and even suicidal. They think there's no fun in life anymore, there's no joy in life. They've seen the movies, they've had the relationships, and they don't live up to what they're promised. So they just give in, not in the right way, and commit suicide or get into other addictions. There is a fundamental error here. We always feel that happiness is our right, and when something happens, we don't understand the causes, that we decide just to kill ourselves or kill somebody. Terrorists. So instead, we have this beautiful way of learning how to get happiness through stillness. If a person just goes watching their breath in Buddhist meditation, of course the mind's going to wander off. It's just like painting a wall which is all greasy and dirty. Or like carrying a cloth which is oily and trying to dye it. You've got to take that grease, that oil, that dirt out first of all, and then you can paint it. The foundations, the preparation is so important. And even watching the breath, the first thing to do is to relax, slow down, to make the body comfortable and to settle the mind down. Only when the mind is reasonably still and peaceful, its energies start to regenerate. And it's so easy to watch the breath. Many people, like people from overseas, they go to some of the beautiful beaches in Sri Lanka. They go to these resorts where they can just lay down in the sun and just do nothing all day. Do they do nothing all day? Of course not. They've got to read a book, they've got to go swimming, snorkeling, they've got to listen to music, they've got to have parties, eating. People have lost the art of relaxing and doing nothing. It's one of the terrible things in today's world, that we're constantly agitated and never know how to be peaceful. So just trying to watch the breath and force the mind onto the breath, of course it's not pleasant. So instead we learn how to relax. When you relax, things become very, very enjoyable. Even studies become enjoyable when you don't have to do them. If you have to do them because it's schoolwork, then, of course, it's very difficult. I get some wisdom from cartoon strips. There is one cartoon strip which is called Calvin and Hobbes. And in the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon, Calvin and Hobbes were just out playing and they found a worm in the garden or in the park. And they were looking at the worm, looking at the worm, looking at the worm, and just wondering, which is its head, which is its tail? How does it eat? What does it do? And so they went to the library and got a book out on worms. And they were looking at that for hours, and the comment was, they'll never get you to do this study if it's schoolwork, but if you enjoy and you're interested in it, of course you can spend hours doing it. It's a difference between schoolwork which is forced, and you need to be tested about it afterwards, and schoolwork which you enjoy doing. You really want to do it. You see the purpose, it's interesting. So that's the same when people do meditation because they think they should do it. Because I'm a Buddhist monk, I should meditate. Or whether you do it because you like it. It's interesting, it's fascinating. So that's one of the reasons why people find it hard to concentrate. Because they're using force. Instead of doing it because they love to do it, they enjoy doing it.
Talking about joy and happiness, we live in this world where everyone has to be successful. But a lot of the time we don't know what really success is. What is a Buddhist should be looking as success?
Okay, I've said this many times and I'll probably say it once a day now, that when I was young, I was taught, and I believe this, you have to work hard. And if you're successful, you pass your exams, get good degrees, get a good reputation, and be really wealthy. And then when you're successful, then you'll be happy. And I saw too many people who were successfully, who were a mess. All these successful people, good examples, that Harvey Weinstein, the sexual predator, very successful. Why does he need to abuse our people in his studios. Makes no sense to me, but there you go, someone who's really successful, but obviously very unhappy. And then we got people like Daniel Goleman in Emotional Intelligence, was actually advocating, no, be happy first. And if you have a passion in life, something you really enjoy doing, then you'll always be successful in the end. Follow your passion, follow your heart, and then success will come later. And both of those made no sense to me until you realize that happiness is success. Happiness equals success. So if you're happy, congratulations. If you're happy, you've arrived. Baby, you've arrived.
On that happy note, can I ask another question, Bhante? You know, we Buddhist parents emphasize a lot that your children must be obedient to their parents. And the parents in Sri Lanka especially have a lot of aspirations for their children. And many a times they want their children to achieve the dreams that they could not achieve. So there's enormous pressure on children to become this, become that, and not what children are talented, not what children love to do. So in the mind of the child, there's a number of issues. One, they don't want to disappoint their parents. And they have this big guilt, am I being disobedient to my parents if I don't follow my talent, my ambition. At the same time, they go through a lot of agony themselves, having to do something that they don't like. I have met many doctors who have been treating some patients like that in universities, and there are children who have committed suicide because of this. It's a big dilemma. So my question to you, Bhante, is from a child's side, how can you handle it skillfully, and how should parents figure out what is the best for their children? And because we are now living in a world, we really don't know what will be the jobs that will be really good in the next 20 years, Bhante.
So you have to equip your children as best as possible to face such an uncertain competitive world. Unfortunately, the evidence is out there, and that is in the educational system in Finland, where children do not start school till at least about 7 or 8 years of age. There is no preschool, no kindergarten, no grade one, grade two, grade three. They start school about 7 or 8. 4 hours, I think, a day. No homework. No homework. When I say that to kids, they say, can we please move to Finland straight away? And they always get in the top 1, 2, or 3 when they test the different abilities of children of the same age. The Finnish school system is radical, but it works. So the children do not have the pressure at such an early age. They require children to have a childhood, to play, to have their friends, to get into some difficulties like getting all muddy, bruised and dirty, to improve their immune system by exposure to germs and bacteria, to break a bone here, a bone there, to strengthen. This is what the body is meant for. It's set up for this, but to also have play and exploration. So they're in that system, they don't force the kids, and they come out on top. So there's a system there, but many governments are too afraid to follow what has been seen to work. From the kids' point of view, unfortunately, that you're not in Finland. For those who are education ministers, for goodness sake, stop killing our kids. Stop measuring them at such an early age and forcing them, trying to be something they're not. For parents, and I say this, you know, to support the children. If your child comes in the top 5% or bottom 5%, no, let's say 10%, the top 10% of school or bottom 10% of school, as Buddhist parents, you're doing a terrible job. Shame on you. In Buddhism, we believe in the middle way. If your kids come in the middle, well done. Why do people react like that? Because they know you have to get kids coming in the top 10%, not the bottom 10%. There'll be failures, just like Richard Branson, terrible at school, always getting punished. And he came out multi-billionaire. So if your kid's coming in the bottom few percent, maybe the school is not recognizing other talents which they have. So whatever, first of all, don't force your children to love your children for who they are. In other words, to give them that trust, even from an early age. And kids will never usually let down a parent's trust. They do want to please you. They don't want to be forced, that's all. They've got to find their own levels in education and in life. So if you give them that emotional strength to say that they are loved, they're cared for, they have a home, they have a family, no matter how they turn out, that famous story of my father, the son, wherever you turn out in life, you know, the door of my house will always be open to you. Now, one story which I don't know if you know, this is just by the way, but personal stories are always interesting. It was a legitimately poor home, had many migrants who were at my school. I thought that was natural, but it, you know, certainly was a multicultural school. You know, for people from Eastern Europe, from Africa, and from all sorts of places. They're my friends. But we were poor, and through scholarships went to a high school. I had some natural abilities there. And it came, I think, about the second or third year in the high school, at the one night parents-teachers meeting. I found out afterwards from my friends, as soon as I went to school the following morning, they were already interested. Hey, your dad, your father, almost had a fight with our teacher. And the teacher was very fearsome. He'd been in a tank in Italy during the Second World War, was blown up. And so his face was, you know, rearranged, like a bit of like a monster. One of his fingertips had been cut off and he had a little bit of bone pointing up. It was all healed up, but he looked a bit frightening. He was a tough man, that teacher. But my father and my teacher almost had a fight. And it took me a while to find out afterwards. The teacher called me up first thing in the morning. He said, do you really want to go to university? I said, yeah, of course. Well, good. Don't care what your father says, you're going to university. My father was resisting me going to university, especially a snooty university like Cambridge, because it took me a while to understand that he was surprised at this. It wasn't in his plans for me. That, you know, he was working class and he thought that going to an elite university would take his son away from him, taking his son into a world where he didn't know, where he didn't belong. And he can understand your child is part of you. You know, you feel that you want to keep them close to you emotionally, intellectually, and also physically in the same town, even the same street. And that was very hard for him to let me go into a world which, you know, was beyond him. He was a simple man. But he soon came around within a day. It was interesting to me to see just how tough it is for a parent to actually to let the child go, to give the child its wings and let it fly off. You miss them terribly. But that is the job of being a parent. to care and to love so much, you let them go. It was a shame, it was sad. He was never there to see me get to university. But nevertheless, he approved to let your child go where they feel their happiness lies. So it's important to be able to look after your children, trust them, and let them go. You give them everything you possibly can. But the most important thing is this trust and this love. My father wasn't rich. My mother wasn't rich. When she died a few years ago, my brother called up and said, "I've gone through your mother's accounts. There's £5,000 in it. Do you want to go for a lawyer?" I said, "The lawyer will take everything. Only £5,000. So we split it 50-50. "Yeah, do you want to see the accounts?" "Nah." And so he just sent the £2,500 to Monastery of Perth. That's all she was worth at the end of her life. But she's worth obviously much more than that. The inheritance which I got, which I still haven't spent yet, still lots left over, was a great example of kindness and love and trust which they gave to me. The great examples. That's what our children learn. So this is how we look after children. For success in life, it's not passing exams. It's not giving them lots of money which they can spend. It's giving them good examples. Living in a small apartment, really small, probably, honestly, you can probably fit two of those apartments into this room we're in right here, just this room here, where I grew up. But it was wonderful. Always sharing a small room with my brother, who I saw a couple of weeks ago. My brother's not a Buddhist, he's a banker. But, you see us together, we love each other a lot. The reason is because we had to share a room together about 16 or 17 years. We had to learn how to love each other. There's no other option. And also, just my mum and dad, dear old mum and dad, they would argue like any married couple. And they would not talk to each other for hours. But it was worth it, seeing my mother and father argue with each other, not talk to each other. And they couldn't escape from each other, they couldn't escape from the children. And so after a while they just gave in and they made up. And you know, I love those memories of seeing my mum and dad make up. It doesn't matter who was right, who was wrong. And I saw that's what I learned as a child. Arguments happen, disagreements happen. But what the beautiful part of a disagreement is the making up afterwards. The forgiveness, come on, you know, I've got to live with you, so let's forgive, let go, learn. And that's a beautiful part, what I learned. Not sort of money, not discipline, but examples of kindness, examples of wisdom. And that's my inheritance. So thank you, Mum and Dad, for my inheritance.
Talking about kids, and kids today have to give in to so much of peer pressure because they come from different social backgrounds, and there is this, there is that their friends do, friends go for, and if you can't keep them up, you feel you are left alone. And this peer pressure is very much when children move from one school to another. You get a scholarship and you go to a higher school, or from a normal school you go to a private school. That every time you move, you know, you meet people from different social backgrounds. And this peer pressure is another major challenge kids of today learn to handle. What are some tips, Bhante, you can give them?
Again, one thing which really impresses your peers is just your self-confidence, just being at peace with yourself no matter sort of how you are. And one of the wonderful things to learn that self-confidence and to understand the solution to peer pressure is when we have classes, I hope they have this in Sri Lanka now, when I went to Hamburg a couple of years ago, one of the Buddhists who was looking after me was also a very senior person who was establishing integration into schools of people with physical or learning disabilities. So a person who, say, had Down syndrome or was a little bit autistic, they were put not into special classes, they weren't segregated. They were put into a class with everybody else. No segregation at all, no streaming. Which meant that the children grew up in a real world. In a real world, you may know somebody, and somebody in your family who may be a little bit autistic, somebody who is schizophrenic, somebody who is sort of disabled in one area or the other in their body. And these are in the normal class in a normal school. So the children in the school, this is my mate over here, he's a little bit autistic, but he's my friend. And we learn such compassion for people not always having to be the same, which takes away this idea of having to live up to some ideal standard. If everybody in the class as geniuses, is beautiful, really high achievers, of course that is going to engender more competition, not less. But if you have a whole range of abilities, of disabilities as well, in a group, it is going back to what we saw in villages in olden days. In a village in Sri Lanka, you'd have children of all types of abilities, and they would love one another, care for one another, and there'd be no peer pressure there. I still recall in the village Bungwai in northeast of Thailand, there was one woman there, one girl, who was mute, who could not speak Thai language or any language, except through grunts. It was a wonderful experience to see this girl, because being a monk in a village, you were basically part of that village, just outside in the forest. But you got to know everybody. And this girl would grunt. And her friends who'd grown up with her knew exactly what that grunt meant. It was a language which only one person could speak and her close friends could understand perfectly. She was part of the village. She was accepted. And I must admit, that was the girl. I was cleaning up the Dhanasala one day, it was my duty. And I saw her just come in. She never saw me at first. And actually, I hid behind a cupboard to watch what she was up to. And she looked as if like she was a thief coming in and looking around, making sure no one was there. And she came and she put something on the shrine in front of the Buddha. She put it there, bowed quickly and ran out. And I thought, what is this disabled girl? What's she done? And I went up there, and she'd folded in paper a little lotus flower. It wasn't the most beautiful lotus flower which you could buy from a shop, but she'd made it. And she was so embarrassed, thinking, if I put it in here, maybe no one will let me, or they'll throw it out. And there it was, this beautiful gift she'd made. Because it took her such a lot of effort. So that evening, at tea time, I told the other monks, said, that lotus flower there, folded out of paper, this is who it's come from. I don't usually get angry, but if anyone throws that out, I'm going to scold you. You may not think it's beautiful in its form, but for the effort and the care which was necessary to make that was immense. Leave it there. She was accepted as part of the village, part of the community. The peer pressure wasn't there. So that's one wonderful way of overcoming the peer pressure in schools. For goodness sake, don't have special classes. Everyone in the same class, like the real world. Disabled, but don't look quite the same. Please let them in. They're part of life.
Bohoma Ping and much merit, Bhante. It was a wonderful discussion. We started with the effects of modern science on Buddhism, and we ended up with the little story of how a little child who is disabled make a nice paper flower offered to Buddha. And that symbolizes the beauty of this moment where we discover the gem that is within each one of us. We are so grateful that you spent your time here, and we are so fortunate to have you here. Hope to see you soon. Pante.